Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome to Behind the Knife's intern advice episode. Today, we're going to take you through some clinical scenarios that you'll likely face when you're hitting the floors here in just about a week. We also hear from guests around the country and the world and get their advice on how they survived and thrived during their intern year. And we'll also talk about some great resources that you can access to really help prepare well for your operative cases, the ab site. And we'll also discuss some philosophy of not just surviving intern year, but dominating it.
Everybody, full disclosure, has different ways that they manage things. And our goal today is just to try to give some overall tips for where you can go wrong, what our thought process in dealing with these different clinical scenarios, but understand that you have to manage the patient in front of you. So with that in mind, Kevin, Jason, you guys are collectively, Kevin, what are you again?
A three.
And Jay?
A four.
So we got our stellar threes and fours, about to be fours and fives, or maybe about to be threes and fours. I can't keep them straight. But the bottom line is the fact that you've been there, you've done that, and you both excelled when the time when you're resident. So Jay, you're called to the floor. The nurse gives you a call. Let's start off with the very basics. You're in your call. She says, hey, Mr. Jones, 777, he's got heart rate on the monitor. He's tachycardia, and it looks like a funny pattern. Tell me what's going through your mind.
Well, like you said, the first thing you have to do is you have to treat the patient in front of you. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go immediately and see the patient.
Exactly. There we go. And you'd be unbelievable how often that simple fact does not occur. Getting out of bed and going seeing the patient. You are a rookie. You are a newbie. You don't know anything. I think the thing that I remember most about my intern year is that I knew nothing. And you think you know a lot graduating from medical school, and you don't. So go see the patient. So you get up, you walk in, see Mr. Jones, and what you see there is you're standing there, the nurse hands you the rhythm strip and tachycardia, and let's say they got AFib with RVR. It's a post-op cabbage patient. What are your thought process with this patient?
The first assessment you have to make is this patient stable? Is this patient unstable? Because that takes you down different algorithms. If the patient is stable and their blood pressure is stable, then you're focused on rate control, and then that gives you a little time to figure out why they're going into AFib with RVR, and you can address the underlying problem.
So as you're seeing this particular patient, let's say first scenario, they're unstable.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when you're going to get the defibrillator pads in there and put them on their chest and repeat the blood pressure. And if they're still unstable, you're going to start pacing them. You're going to convert them.
Yeah, so it depends on what you're looking at. But more importantly, probably what's the first thing that you're going to do in that situation are 10 days. Rhymes with call for help.
Of course.
Yeah, you're gonna call for help soon, and you're going to call for help immediately.
While your resident is coming to see you, you're going to get the pads on the patient, though, so they're ready to go if they do need it.
Yeah, one of my chief residents told me a long time ago, and I think it's imperative throughout time, is that especially when you're unfamiliar with a situation and when you're fresh on your feet, it's probably good to load the boat, get more people involved, and you have residents around. And, you know, you can never go wrong for calling help. You may be able to handle it just fine, and when it's the 47th time or the 400th time or the first time, probably a good idea to be able to do that. So is the patient, Jason, you said it best, is the patient stable or unstable? And depending on that algorithm, and most interns nowadays, they're going to take their ACLS guidelines and you go down those guidelines. But it's important to think about a couple of different reasons. And what are the reasons potentially for AFib with RVR? Kevin?
Well, the most common one will be the post-op day 3 patient that's volume overloaded.
Okay, so I don't know if it's the most common one, but yeah, that's a good point. So yeah, let's just build a differential diagnosis. So they're mobilizing fluids in somebody who can't necessarily handle that extra volume. And in that situation, we need to manage their volume appropriately, and we need to help them out with a little bit of what?
Lasix.
Yeah, or some sort of diuresis. We need to plan for that. And again, it's probably better to keep patients in the box, meaning that they get all their numbers squared away and normal, than it is for them to be reactive. So proactive versus reactive. So if you see it coming on morning rounds, let's try to be a little bit more proactive, keeping in mind that as an intern, as one of my other mentors say, it's very good to have independence of thought, but maybe not on your second day to have independence of action, our 4 days. So,
but that's I think it's an important thing to note for the interns, because, you know, the interns are really going to be the people on morning rounds that are going to, they should know the numbers inside and out. They can be the person on post-op day three and say, hey, you know what, guys, this guy is 6 liters up. His urine output's starting to pick up a little bit. He's post-op day three. Should we start diuresing him today? That should really come from the intern level on day three, if you ask me.
Absolutely. And so, again, we want interns out there. Everybody does. Whether you're a senior resident, a junior resident, or a staff surgeon, you want the interns to manage the patients, because they're eventually going to be your patients. But again, it's important to understand that you may not understand the greater scope or the particulars of a staff surgeon, which residents, by the time they graduate, they not only know their date of birth, their favorite ice cream, their, you know, girlfriend's color hair, but they also know how they manage patients. So it's important that you understand that there are variances with each individual staff. So that is imperative. Other things that come up is a patient may have underlying, you know, AFib, that they don't necessarily have their rate control, they're missing their beta blocker, they have electrolyte abnormalities. All these things are in your differential diagnosis and it should go along the way. So second scenario, Jay, you got a patient post-op day, let's say they're post-op day two and they present with low urine output from a sigmoid colectomy or a Whipple.
Right. So, you know, I think the key with this scenario is that you don't want to just blindly bolus somebody. That's medicine stuff. That's not surgery stuff. If you get a patient that has low urine output, you want to figure out why they have low urine output. And with a lot of surgical patients, your first three differentials for that should be bleeding. So you need to, again, assess the patient. You need to look at their vitals. Are they tachycardic and have low urine output? Are they febrile and have low urine output? Or are they, you know, somebody who's on, you know, is fine otherwise, but hey, at home they take a diuretic and they haven't been started on their diuretic yet and they have low urine output.
Or did Kevin cut both ureters in part of the process?
And our sigmoidectomy patient, yes, exactly. Are so they putting 600 out of their JP drain?
Exactly, right? So the bottom line with these patients is, again, going back to highlighting some of the things, what we're trying to get you to be able to do is, if you heard Jason said it suddenly, he said, assess the patient. What are their vital signs? So again, sepsis, low urine output, stable patient, low urine output, hypotension, low urine output, or lower urine output with otherwise stable vital signs, that takes you down different pathways. So assessing that patient, seeing where they're at, look at what their morning labs are, what's the trend are, what's their medications, because, you know, they could be simply nothing more than hypotensive because they got, you know, too much, a double dose. You never know what happens on the floor, a double dose of some blood pressure pill, or somebody inadvertently charted on the wrong patient, or it could be the weirder things that have happened, and they just need a little bit more of a forward flow. So go back and assess the patient.
So just to touch a little bit further on patients with low urine output, if you go back to your medicine days, you can really break this down into pre-renal, renal, or post-renal. In a lot of our surgical patients, one of the main causes is going to be urinary retention. So you're going to be getting a lot of bladder scans as an intern, or asking the nurses to get a lot of bladder scans. So if they're retaining, generally you'll place a Foley catheter. So Jason, you do the bladder scan and the nurse says there's 50 cc's in the bladder. What's the next step you're going to go down?
Well, that leaves us basically to the pre-renal, or, you know, the renal oliguria. And a lot of people out there might be surprised to hear, you know, we actually rely pretty not infrequently on the FeNA. That's the fractional excretion of sodium in a lot of our surgical patients. And it's important to know how to order this as an intern, because you can't just go up to the nurse and say, hey, get me a FeNA. You have to know what goes into it. So what goes into it is you need your serum creatinine level, you need your serum sodium level, and you also need your urine creatinine level and your urine sodium level. So you can get this by ordering a BNP. That'll give you the numbers you need from your plasma levels, but you also have to specifically order a urine creatinine and a urine sodium. And then I'm not going to go into exactly how to calculate that because we all have iPhones these days, and you can pull up your MedCalc and enter in the numbers into a medical calculator, and it'll tell you what your FINA is. But it is important to know how to interpret those numbers. So typically, Kevin, what's the numbers we look for less than what percent would tell us that this person may be a little dry or maybe a pre-renal?
Right, that's the less than 1%.
Right, and important to note, just because they're dry doesn't mean they're dehydrated. You have to find out why they're pre-renal. They may be pre-renal because they're bleeding. That will make you pre-renal. And the other thing that commonly comes up, and you'll interns will probably get pimped on this in rounds, is what do you do if the patient's on a diuretic, a Lasix? That makes your FINA inaccurate, but what else can you order?
So this is where you have to get the FEurea.
Right. So you have to know that. If your patient, you have to know what your patient's on. If they're on Lasix, you're not going to get a FINA, you're going to get an FEurea. So you need to order your plasma urea level as well as your urine urea level to calculate that. And for those numbers, it's typically below 30% will tell you you're pre-renal.
Kevin, now you got a patient who is 85 years old, and they have present. The nurse calls you, and she says he's got a temperature of 101.4, and it's post-op day 2 after a small bowel resection.
You know, what we like to define as a surgical fever is 101.5.
Yeah, that's a huge difference between a 101.4 and 101.5.
So clearly, this patient is not sick, nor will they get sick with a 101.4.
Oh, and atelectasis is the leading cause of fever. I love that one, too.
Right.
That's fantastic. Have them blow on a tube, which they should blow on, incentive spirometer. I'm not saying that. But so anyway, so what are their five W's that we think of? They're good to note because they're all important, and it kind of takes you down a pathway. But again, we go see the patient, we look at the vital signs, and what are you going to do? What are you, as you're walking down the hallway to see this patient, what are your five W's, and where do you go from there?
Right, so I'm going to look at their wound for one of them. I'm going to get a UA on them. It's very common in these post-op patients to have a urinary tract infection. Generally going to get a chest x-ray for wind to check their lungs. What are the other two, Jason?
Wind, water, walking.
Oh, there's wound. Wonder Drug. I don't do anything for that one.
Wonder Drug. And DVTs.
DVTs.
Yeah. Bottom line is the fact that, again, these are very common scenarios, but what happens a lot of times is that people forget to look at the wound. And especially when you're some keys into the problem with the wound is the fact that you have very obviously some redness you may not see because most of us may use a silver dressing or, oh my God, don't take the dressing down because it's a sterile or whatever thing is. But when they're very high fevers and the patient's not doing well, you got to make sure that you look at that wound and make sure that there's no problems with that wound. Again, we're thinking about DVT, we're thinking about drugs, we're thinking about, you know, pneumonias, urinary tract infections, all of those things that are coming to mind. And the five W's, more than anything, they serve as a baseline differential diagnosis to start your workup from there. So
all this kind of leads into what goes into a full fever workup. So when you're an intern and it's in the middle of the night and you're getting called for a patient with a fever, you need to know what tests are you going to go for? And it's all those things we just talked about. You're going to get a CBC, looking at their white count, see if it's going up from where it was this morning. You're going to, and another thing you might want to look at is the platelets, because the platelets will actually go up as an inflammatory marker. So that can be give you an idea as well. You're going to get a UA, looking for urinary tract infections. Some labs will reflexively send a urine culture if the UA is positive. Others, you'll have to order that. So you'll have to, if the UA is positive, you'll have to send a urine culture. You want to get blood cultures as a baseline set because you may be starting antibiotics. You're going to get a chest x-ray looking for, a pneumonia. And if all this stuff comes back negative, the patient's still febrile, you can't figure out why, then you're going to start going down that algorithm. And first, you're going to do a physical exam and look to see if there's any evidence of a DVT, but you may want to start considering getting some duplex ultrasounds looking for a DVT. And depending on why that patient's there, what kind of surgery they had, you may need to start looking at imaging, looking into the other body cavities. If they had an open exploratory laparotomy for a perforated appendicitis, you might want to start thinking about maybe they're forming an intra-abdominal abscess and you need to get a CT scan looking for that. But all that is to be said, you can get these initial things running, the fever workup, the chemistry, or I'm sorry, the CBC, the chest x-ray, the UA, while you're calling your senior level resident to come help out and assess the patient.
And now we'll take a quick break and hear a tip from one of our listeners. All right, here we are in Behind the Knife, and we are working on our episode where we are getting advice from residents around the country. And our first resident that is calling in is Andrea Merrill of Mass General. She has completed 3 clinical years in her research time at Mass General is actually about to do a editorial fellowship at the New England Journal, notably one of the first surgeons to do this. So we're proud of her for that. Welcome, Andrea, to Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much.
You had a story you wanted to tell us, and that kind of fit in with the piece of advice that you gave us. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you. So being an intern is pretty scary. It's very different than being a medical student. I think the kind of the shift in sense of responsibility really changes things and is stressful in a way I never really imagined. And it's easy, very easy to get overwhelmed. And I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned as an intern, and actually I continue to learn throughout my years, is to really listen to the nurses, be nice to the nurses, and they're going to help you and save you. And actually a story that kind of sticks out in my mind was more as a senior resident when I was on night float and I was supervising some interns. And I went to go check on a patient who I'd heard had a big surgery, and I wanted to check in, make sure the patient's doing okay. And on my way to the recovery room, I ran into some nurses, and I said I was on my way to see the patient. And they're like, oh, no, you want to go the other way. There's a sick patient in the other recovery room. And so I ran there, and sure enough, there was my intern, scared, kind of paralyzed, didn't know what to do. And there was a patient who had a thyroidectomy that day who was hoarse and was developing stridor and had an expanding hematoma. And my intern didn't really know what to do and hadn't called me yet. And luckily I arrived then. And the nurses, they hand you this brown paper bag that they keep at the bedside, which I have seen countless times at the bedside. And I've never actually really known what was in there.
Yeah.
And you know, you always hear about a rapidly expanding hematoma after a thyroidectomy, and I'd never seen one before.
Right.
And so they hand me this brown bag, and I look inside, and it's just a, you know, set of pickups and a, you know, pair of scissors from the suture removal kit. And I was like, what am I supposed to do with that? And some of the seasoned nurses who had been there and actually seen it, like, you just cut the sutures out. So they got the suction ready because I had seen this before, and I just cut the sutures out. We suctioned it out. The patient immediately felt better. We rushed her off to the OR, and she was fine and left the next day. But listening to the nurses really, really saved me, saved the patient.
That is perfect. It's not only did they alert you to the patient, but they also, you know, more or less walked you through what to do.
Right, exactly.
You know, a lot of times we think that they, you know, only can observe, but they've seen many, many years of this procedures being done. And so they're great people to learn from.
Well, yeah, I mean, they probably could have done it themselves, but, you know, a lot of them have been around for a while and they've seen this. I had never seen it. So, and, you know, when a nurse tells you a patient's sick or is about to get sick, you know, to listen to them, because I've had many nights where I've been on and they're like, you know, I think the patient's going to have a spike of fever, or they just don't look that great. And when a nurse tells you that, you want to make sure that you go right there, check the patient out, and kind of keep checking on the patient, because almost all the time they're right.
Great. And to finish out this little segment here, Andrew, I think what we'll do is we'll start asking each of the residents that calls in to this episode, you know, what is all of us, especially in general surgery, has a high attrition rate. I'm sure there's been times where you've been down on yourself. You've questioned your choice of specialty. What do you grasp onto? How do you get through those times when you're down on yourself?
That's a really good question. I would say a lot of us struggle with this, sometimes more than others. I would say intern year can be very challenging, and there are some weeks you just, you know, every day you're like, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? You know, a lot of it is I turn to my co-residents in my class, and also looking up to the senior residents that I work with. I remember we have this thing called 9 o'clock meal. Night float, and we go to the cafeteria, and they give us all the leftovers for free. It's pretty gross, but it's more a sense of camaraderie. I've started bringing my own food, but I still go down there to kind of bond with the residents. You see who's on call at night. And my favorite part from when I was an intern was to be with my senior resident or chief resident and hear them tell stories about when they were interns and how scared they were and times they messed up. And sometimes I'm like, oh, if they can become what they are now, then there's some hope for me.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's one thing. The other is to, you know, obviously you're really busy as an intern and a resident, but to try and keep up something, one of your hobbies at least, outside of medicine, to kind of keep you sane, whether it's working out or for me, cooking and baking, you know, music, photography, anything else. It's kind of good to have a hobby, even if you only do it occasionally. It kind of keeps you sane.
Well, that was really great, Andrea. We really appreciate it. And we wish you the best of luck next year at the New England Journal.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Jay, another patient comes in and you just get a call in the PACU. This is a common scenario. They're in the PACU and you get a call. It's a 79-year-old lady. She underwent some sort of an abdominal operation and she's hypotensive.
Well, in the PACU again, it all comes down to the patient. Once again, you gotta look at that particular patient. How did they get? Are they hypotensive and tachycardic? Are they bleeding? Like I said, you know, for hypotension and in your immediately post-op patient, you know, your number one thing on your mind should be bleeding. Number two should be bleeding, and number three should be bleeding.
Yep.
From there, you know, you want to assess. You know, if this patient's an older patient, maybe they have a cardiac history, or you know, did they just have a massive MI? Did they have a perioperative MI? So you want to go down your algorithm, you want to send off your labs, you want to call for help early. You know, hypotension is something you should definitely be scared of. You shouldn't just blindly bolus them. Their MAP comes back up and then you forget about them. You check your CBC, you check your troponin, you check your EKG, and you go from there.
Kevin, flip it opposite now. The nurse calls you and she's extremely worried about, or he is extremely worried about the fact that the patient has a blood pressure of 189 over 110. They're hypertensive. What's your thought process? What are some things that are going along your mind?
This can also be a cardiac event in the patient, so you want to do the similar cardiac workup. And one of the more common reasons for hypertension postoperatively can be pain, also including... they can be off their medications if these patients are on multiple blood pressure medications. And so these are a few of the things that you want to think about initially.
So should I give the patient, am I that worried if they're 160 over 98, should I start giving them hydralazine or enalaprilat?
Right. No, we're much more liberal than the medicine doctors, at least in the very initial postoperative period, to kind of see where their blood pressure is going to take them until they get into the hypertensive crisis type area of the 180s and above.
Well, you're okay with a little hypertension after surgery.
Yeah,
I'm less scared about a little hypertension than I am hypotension. You have a little more time to figure it out, address their pain, you know, check a few blood pressures before you get crazy and controlling it.
But you're certainly not going to be hitting them with fast-acting blood pressure medications right in the PACU or on the floor.
Yeah, again, it goes back to, are they in a hypertensive crisis? That's a completely different scenario. But it's not uncommon for patients to have a little bit of hypertension and, as exactly as you two boys said, that the bottom line is the fact that, you know, they may need a forward flow. They may need hypertension as a baseline. So that's a great time to do as a little bit of a chart biopsy to look and see what are they on, what did they run, what was their outpatient blood pressure in their pre-anesthetic unit appointment. That's a very nice scenario to see where they normally live, because let's face it, a lot of patients with multiple comorbidities may live in the 180s, the 200s, and we need to be worried about that. And you mentioned one of the things, Kevin, was pain management, that the person is in pain. So I will tell you that obviously pain management is specifically as it relates to post-op abdominal surgeries changing. We're trying to go away from narcotics. We're trying to use multimodality therapy, but you get a call from somebody who's in 10 out of 10 pain. 10 out of 10 pain. I'm in 10 out of 10 pain as they're jump roping in their room. So what can you tell me?
The first thing, and you'll get these calls a lot. This is probably one of the most common calls as an intern. The nurses want you to give them pushes of Dilaudid, and you can just say it over the phone. Yeah, I'll write for it, and you don't have to go see the patient. But that's the wrong thing to do, especially in this patient that is post-op with 10 out of 10 pain. So you want to go see them. I mean, I'm thinking something went wrong, peritoneal signs. That's why they're in 10 out. That's generally what 10 out of 10 pain is caused by, not by an abdominal incision. So you go evaluate the patient. You look at their vital signs. You see if they're peritoneal or if it truly is just incisional pain. And if that's the case, then you kind of go down a different algorithm of, okay, are we covering our bases with the basic pain management if there is nothing seriously wrong with the patient? Okay, to go a little more in depth in the patient that has uncontrolled pain, there's a few things you can think of once you've ruled out peritonitis or surgical complication. One thing, honestly, really does work, and the nurses are generally pretty good about trying this before they call you, but using heat packs, repositioning in bed, you want to try some of those therapies first before you jump to medicating these patients. One medication that is sometimes forgotten is Tylenol. It really adds a nice background to help control their pain, and depending on the institution, IV Tylenol really works, especially for the ICU patients. It really seems to add a lot. Another one you want to consider before jumping into the narcotics is a Toradol or an IV NSAID. You want to make sure these patients don't have kidney disease, and you also want to make sure they're not at high risk for bleeding, which is a lot of our post-surgical patients. So a lot of places you'll want to run this by your upper level before starting something such as Toradol. But Jason, how about the narcotics?
Well, yeah, and before we get to narcotics, I think an important point is, just to give a little disclaimer here that this is going to vary a lot based on the institution, based on the individual attending, based on the individual patient. So there is no one pain management, algorithm or protocol that applies to all patients. But in general, what I typically like to approach it as, it's going to vary depending on if the patient is taking oral intake or whether they're taking only IV. But having a good baseline non-narcotic, such as a Tylenol, either oral or IV, or some of the NSAIDs, Motrin or Toradol, or even Caldolor, which is a new IV form of Motrin, and then some breakthrough pain with some narcotics, either oral or IV. From there, you can go to some of your PCAs or your patient-controlled analgesia, which a lot of times will give a little better pain control. And if you're still having trouble, I mean, this is definitely the time to be calling for help. The acute pain service or anesthesia has things like lidocaine drips, or even they're doing ketamine drips now on the floor for managing the really severe pain. And an important point is, whenever you're prescribing any of these medications, you need to know the indications as well as the contraindications. So like Kevin was saying, if you have a patient who has renal disease and you give them Toradol, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do the next morning. So until you really get comfortable with this, you need to be involving your more senior resident.
And one thing to keep in mind, when you're using these IV medications and the PCAs, it really is nice to have, if they can tolerate orals, to have an oral on board, like a oxycodone, that really will help give them sort of the baseline pain control. Because if you look at sort of the nomograms for patients getting IV pushes, their pain, it knocks them out. They don't press their PCA for a long time, and they wake up in excruciating pain and start pressing it again, and they go through these cycles, where if you get a nice background with some oral medications, it can really help prevent that. And let's hear from one of our listeners in Australia. Welcome, Stuart Morrison, to Behind the Knife. He is a registrar, or in the United States, we call a resident in orthopedic surgery in Melbourne, Australia. And I have to apologize. I have tortured him with calling him at 3 in the morning, at 4 in the morning. And I finally figured out the Australian time, and finally talking to him at 5 in the morning in Australia. It took us about 2 weeks to get connected. Thank you, Stuart, so much for taking the time and having the patience to deal with me.
No, that's fine. I'm just as patient with my own hospital, who calls me at those hours as well. So hopefully I wasn't jumping on the phone.
Yeah, great. And I was just hoping you could take us through a quick scenario as an intern that stressed you out, and how you did with it, how you dealt with it.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of stressful situations as an intern. I think it's probably the most stressful year of anyone's training. When I was an intern on a country rotation about 3 hours north of Melbourne, I had a patient who was thrombocytopenic. My registrar, or you call them residents, as you said, was off for the afternoon, and I was left by the physician in charge to sort out this person's platelets, whatever that entails. They weren't actively bleeding. I saw the number of 9, which I knew was very, very low, and we went down the process of trying to get some platelets in for the patient. In this country town, with the transfusion nurse finishing at 3 p.m. on weekdays, became somewhat of a problem. I was in a little bit of a panic. I spoke to a neighboring hospital. The additional difficulty is this country town is right on a state border. So though we're geographically closer to one capital city, a lot of the platelets and equipment come from a hospital across the border, whose capital city is obviously in the other state. At the end of the day, I explored both pathways. I was told it was impossible to get them up from Melbourne, that they were more likely to come from Sydney. I said it was urgent, pushed, We find and put some orders in, did various phone calls until about 9 p.m. at night. By 9:30, we'd got some up from Wangaratta, which is a nearby town in Victoria, and given to the platelets. Given to the patient. And then I got a call from the other hospital saying the fixed-wing plane has just landed from the Red Cross, and they've flown all the platelets that I've ordered down from Sydney for the patient. Wow. And not only that, but instead of platelets, I'm not sure whether it's the same in the States, come in pools. So it's one set of platelets is called like five pooled platelets.
Right.
And I'd ordered five lots, so they'd actually had 25 lots. So I think most of the platelets for New South Wales had been flown down in a chartered jet and were not going to be used because they need to be refrigerated. And this, for me, was incredibly stressful. I mean, the patient was fine, got their platelets. But this, here's me at 11 p.m. being blasted about the fact I've spent most of the state's hematology budget. And that was actually the first time in intern year I almost completely broke down. And end up in tears. The good thing with that job was that in a country rotation, we were placed in units with the other interns. And I think the most important things that got me through that was going home and talking to the other interns. I thought that my life was over and my wages for the year were going to be retracted. But then spoke to the consultant first thing in the morning about the situation. And fortunately, he supported me in it and said I had been left a little bit unsupervised. The hospital procedures weren't really well explained or sorted out to address that situation. And then from that, what I actually did proactively before the transfusion nurse got back in touch with me was to write a little summary of events and identify the points that I thought could be improved on.
Great.
So that sort of helped me address the situation. I think it's important in those sort of situations when there's a stressful situation, you sometimes do act a little bit illogically or do things that in retrospect with time weren't the right way of going about things, is to be proactive and not only explain them to your consultant and everyone above you proactively and say, look, this is what's happened, but then also to be very active and be seen to be very active in addressing the situation to prevent it happening to your fellow interns or people down the line.
No, that is great advice. And I think you really bring across one great point is that if you're taking care of the patient, if that's your focus and that's what you're doing, no matter what happens, you'll end up all right, as long as you keep that your focus. And so as you might have depleted the whole blood bank, but it was for the best for your patient, and that's why you were able to stay in the clear.
And that's a good point. And you'll find in you are the main advocate as a junior doctor for that patient. You'll find often that there's people with a lot of different services they're advocating for, whether it's a hospital budget or an ambulance transfer budget, and you've always got people asking you to just cut some corners. Do we really need to book an ambulance? Can't this person go in a car? Do they need a chopper? Can't we put them in a road ambulance? Do they really need platelets? Can we get away with this? Do we really need to put a new plaster on? And the answer is probably yes, and you need to think, this person may be acting in the interest of their budget or their time constraints or anything, but you're the main person who has to push for what the patient actually needs. And that's very empowering to keep in mind, and that's why you're the decision maker as an intern, not a lot of the people around you.
I'm glad to see that you guys have the same frustrations as interns in Australia as we do in the States. I can remember dealing with all that vividly. Thank you for that great piece, and it's something that we don't really think about. We really don't give people advice on that sort of topics. Normally we give the chest pain and the tachycardia advice, but that's really what they're going to deal with more with and have more headaches with is the administrative side. So that was great.
And I mean, every new hospital you work at, you're presented with a repository of thousands of policies and procedures and documents, and to try and digest them all is impossible, and they don't usually address a lot of the bizarre situations you end up in as an intern.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite situations is you walk into a new hospital to take call. They hand you the pagers, and you don't even have access to the medical records yet, and your pagers are going off, and you don't even barely know where you're at. But so speaking of that, and speaking of getting stressed out, residency can be tough. It can be tough for weeks, months, years long at a time. How do you stay positive? What do you do when you're down in those tough times?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. I think, as I alluded to before, it's important to have that support structure around you, as cliche as that sounds. So speaking to work colleagues, hanging out with fellow interns or people you've gone through medical school with outside of the job is good. It's often very frustrating for everyone's partners and other friends because all you want to do is talk shop. But it's good to just have that debriefing and have those people around you who can empathize or sympathize with your stress and got their own situations to share and debrief on. That's been very important to me going through. It's also good to be in hospitals and cities. You're often not in touch with your friends from medical school. Everyone's very busy. Everyone's on different shifts. Just to really make an effort to catch up, and you usually feel a lot better once you do.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Stuart, for everything, and we really appreciated having you on Behind the Knife.
No worries. Thanks for your time, Kevin.
All right, Kevin, and another common thing that you're going to get called on in the middle of the night is tachycardia. The nurse calls you. The patient is post-op day two. Their heart rate's in the one teens.
Yeah, this is a very common call. So the first thing you're going to do, at least what I do, is I just say, okay, I'm coming down now. Get the EKG on my way down there. So by the time I get down there, we have an EKG, and I'm like, is this patient an arrhythmia where we're going to go down the ACLS protocols, or are they sinus tachycardia? Generally, in your post-op surgery patients on the floor, it's probably going to be sinus tachycardia, and that takes you down a few other routes. So Jason, what do you do for your sinus tachycardia workup?
I want a full set of vitals, which you'll be surprised often you don't have. So you want to get the blood pressure, you want to see the patient, make sure they're stable. And then you want to figure out why they're tachycardic. Is this, again, it's a post-operative patient. Are they bleeding? Are they hypotensive? Are they orthostatic? Or are they in pain? Or if they're in 10 out of 10 pain and they're 22 years old and they're a little tachycardic, I may start with trying to control their pain and see if that helps. Are they hypoxic? Another big thing you got to think about in a post-surgical patient who's tachycardic is a pulmonary embolus. So did they have a desaturation event? And from there, you know, I'm going to kind of tailor my workup based on what I see. I'm going to send a CBC to look and see if they're bleeding. I'm going to check their urine output and make sure their urine output's adequate. Potentially get a chest x-ray.
One important point is to not lean too heavily on the patients in pain. That's a diagnosis of exclusion because all your patients are going to be in some level of pain. And so you don't want to rely on pain when they're actually having a leak at their anastomosis or they had a PE and you're just accounting it to pain because they also have pain. All right, Jason, one call you'll get is the nurses. They spend the most time with these patients. They know these patients well, and they'll say, you know, this patient just isn't right. They're talking about weird things. He was, you know, alert and oriented before, and now he's talking about his former deployments and talking crazy. What do you do when you have that kind of call?
Yeah, these can be, this is the altered mental status call. These can actually be very, very challenging because they can be very difficult to work up because it could just be sundowning. This could be an elderly person who has a little baseline dementia. They've been in a hospital for a few days. They're a little confused, and that could be all it is. But again, that's a diagnosis of exclusion. You can't hang your hat on that. So I'm going to go see the patient. I'm going to do a full neurologic exam. I'll look for any focal signs of a neurodeficit. You know, are they having a stroke? And from there, I'm going to do my altered mental status workup, which, altered mental status can be the first sign of sepsis, especially in an elderly patient. They may be getting a little urinary tract infection and becoming a little uroseptic. So I'm going to send a CBC. I'm going to send a UA. I'm going to send a chemistry looking for electrolyte abnormalities. I'm going to get an ABG. Hypoxia or hypercarbia can cause altered mental status. I'm going to get a chest x-ray, you know, again, looking for a pneumonia or mucus plugging or anything like that could be contributing to this. And I'm going to check a finger stick glucose because one of the early, easily correctable things that could kill the patient is hypoglycemia.
That leads us to our next point and probably one of the most important points that I would say. If you're lost and you're an intern, there are certain things that I always say that are applicable in any scenario that you can do. So Jason, you go in, you see a patient, you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they're in the PACU, they're in the ward, they're in the ICU or whatever. What is something that you can absolutely start the process by doing? I call it my five big things in addition to getting up and seeing the patient. Five things. Give me those five.
Yeah, I remember this actually very clearly. You gave me this, gave a lecture to me and my fellow interns when we were interns, and it always stuck with me that if you go in and you just know that there's something wrong, you don't know what, You start with these five basic things. You get a chest x-ray, you get an EKG, you get an ABG, you get labs, a CBC chemistry, and you check a finger stick glucose.
Absolutely. You think about those basic things. EKG, you're ruling out MI, rhythm abnormalities, and ABG, are they hypercarbic? I can remember when I was an intern, I got called on this patient and his oxygenation level was fine, but it just didn't look right. And God, we got a gas on him and his CO2 was sky high, and that was causing his mentation abnormality. You get a CBC and a chemistry. Are you bleeding? Are they septic? White count up, white count in the tank, electrolyte abnormalities, a blood sugar. I can remember when I was an intern, this vascular patient started acting really goofy in the clinic and turned out she had a blood sugar of about 30-something that was wrong. And then a chest x-ray, free air, pneumonia, bronchial collapse, mucus plugging, whatever it is. You get those few things and all of a sudden you got the workup going. But Kevin, in addition to that, it's probably important that you also do another thing. So boom, I order those things. You can do that right now. If you don't have any idea, I'm ordering those five things and I'm rolling from there and I'm starting to assess the patient, physical exam, doing a chart biopsy, doing all those things. What else is important? We mentioned a little bit earlier.
Right. And you need to contact your upper level immediately. And it's important to remember, though, that there's going to be times that your upper level is going to be operating. They're going to be doing a trauma down in the ER and you're going to be the solo person. But it's important to keep them up to date, even if they are busy, because they still need to hear about these patients, however busy they are.
Yeah, and when I was a chief resident, I'd always say it's better to commit an error of than up. Do you guys remember what I told you?
Yeah, to commit an error of commission rather than an error of omission.
Yeah, to stay in bed and say that probably the patient's fine and, you know, not get out, although, obviously, you know, there's night floats and other things like that, and I recognize that the duty hours are different. But the bottom line, it remains the same. You're in the hospital. You're the primary person getting called for these patients. And so important to be, again, to be vigilant, to see the patient, and don't blow anything off, especially in your intern year. I mean, again, take it forward to surgery. When I see a patient right now and they have a lump, it may not be a cancer right away, but that's at least in your, you know, you may think of it for 2 seconds, boom, cancer, and cancer, and you move on, but it's still in your differential diagnosis. So, you know, it's very important that you don't blow anything off in this particular time, especially early in the year, and especially as you're learning how your senior residents, your junior residents, and how everything is doing. Because remember one thing, if I can tell you one thing, you don't know anything.
And that's okay. That's okay.
Absolutely. Listen, the more you go into surgery, you heard Dr. Reed say it on one of our other podcasts. I'm not meaning that as a mean thing.
Yeah.
The more you go along to surgery, that's the fun thing about our job. The further out, you know, I'm whatever, God, I don't know how many years, over a decade out of my residency, you know, and out of my fellowship, I mean, and I you realize, God, there's a lot of gray. There's a lot more to learn. I the things you remember, the things you forget, it all comes hand in hand. So just be important. It is a learning process. And part of that is understanding the entire complex story of the patient. So as we go around a little bit more, the last thing kind of to go and often gets overlooked, especially when you're busy, but it's critically important, especially when you look back and realize what exactly happened, Kevin, is what?
Yeah, you could have done all that work. You could have been checking on this patient every 5 minutes throughout the night, but if you didn't document it, no one's going to believe you. So you got to document every time that you saw the patient and all the updates throughout the night so people the next day can look at it and figure out kind of what happened and the course this patient has been on.
Yeah, I'm not telling you to write a note that says note and then sign it, excellent note by above, see below, or something like that, some fun things in the chart. But the bottom line is the fact that what you need to see is you need to see what's going on with that patient to document your thought process so that as things occur, you can look back and see why it is you did why. And then also remember, you're painting a story of kind of writing a story of what happened to that particular patient. So document, document, document. All right, next thing on. So the other thing that happens less and less, unfortunately, with the changes in the work hour week is residents are getting to operate, interns are getting to operate a little bit more, and oftentimes you're not getting to spend as much time in the operating room just kind of observing, where I think it's very beneficial. But so as a part of that, as a part of operating a little bit more, Jay, how would you talk to interns about how they are to prepare for their operating room cases, understanding once again that different attendings have different things they like done, but just in general, kind of some overall take-home things.
What I would say is find out as far ahead of time what cases you may have, read a little bit about those cases, pick your, you know, surgical text of choice. I don't care if it's a Wikipedia article, and then go talk to the staff ahead of time, because a lot of times you haven't seen this patient, but they have. There might be something particular about the case that is not apparent, you know, some little idiosyncrasy of the case, but that you can only get from the person who saw the patient. And go to them and say, you know, hey, we got this case coming up, you know, next week. It's a hemorrhoid. You know, I've read these things. This is what I'm thinking. You know, can we talk a little bit about the case? And I think that'll go far with a lot of staff.
Yeah, there's no attending out there that's going to mind anybody, whatever level they are, coming up and wanting to talk about the case and showing interest. Remember that residency and surgery is a little bit like dating. The more interest you show in the other person, the more interest they're going to show in you. And that even goes for interns who are rotators on the surgery service. If you're like, oh, I'm going to psychiatry and I don't really want to do surgery, then you're not going to get a good learning experience out of it. But if you show interest, you go up to that person and you even fake it, you'll be surprised at how much more beneficial and how much more fun the rotation is. And so as a part of that, it is important to have some resources available and at your tips, Kevin, to basically say, you know, I've never done a laparoscopic distal pancreatectomy or a robotic APR, and what are some resources that are out there for interns, for anybody at all ages to be able to go through?
Right, and this is a continually evolving list. But one of the ones that we always go to, one of our first that's easily accessible, is the Pfizer Absite review, especially for before you're going to present at Morning Report or things like that. It has a pretty good overview of just about every topic, but that's not going to help you out for your preoperative cases. For your preoperative cases, you're going to want to see a surgical atlas. You're going to get on YouTube and look at the SAGES part of YouTube, and they have the 21 essential operations of a laparoscopic surgeon. I highly recommend all interns go watch those now. They're all about 15 minutes long, and it takes you through the 21 most performed laparoscopic surgeries, and they're just great. Jason had some other favorite sites.
I can't really overemphasize the value of watching videos ahead of time. You can learn a lot from seeing it done. And if you've never seen a case before, watch lots of videos. There's a plethora of all kinds of videos of all surgeries online. So you shouldn't show up for a case and have no idea how the procedure has gone. I always like to try and, no matter what your level is, I like to try and prepare for a case to where if the staff on the other under the table dropped dead, I would feel like I could maybe get the surgery done by myself. And that's really how you should approach it.
And I'd recommend getting things that can be on your e-readers, your Kindles or your iPads, whether you download it. I bought an Atlas on my Kindle for about $100, and so I can access it from my iPhone, I can access it from my iPad at any time. And so when I'm finding out about cases last minute, I have a full surgical Atlas right there in my hands.
Yeah, I think another, you know, again, the American College of Surgeons now has communities that you can go in their community. I know the colorectal one does, and you can have access to additional videos. You know, get a hold of an old op note from one of the staff and see how they like to do it.
Great point.
And then probably the more valuable resource is your upper level residents, your chief residents. Go to them and say, hey, listen, I got a laparoscopic sigmoidectomy and duodenal switch at the same thing with Dr. Martin. And I've never heard of doing that before. And how does he do this? And blah, 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 blah. And your upper level residents are going to be able to say, well, Martin likes to use this. This is how he does his thing, blah, blah, blah. They know. They've been there. They can be valuable resources. Probably in addition, now you got to know how the procedure's done. You got to know the anatomy. You need to be prepared. But you don't want to stand at this. There's nothing that's more annoying than if I'm in the operating room and somebody comes in here and says, hey, I'm working with you today. And you're like, okay, because my first instinct is to say, well, you can watch me. And again, attendings are at academic surgeries because we want to teach. We want you to do the case. I mean, some obviously more than others, but, you know, prepare ahead of time. You're going to get a lot more out of it.
A few more resources we wanted you guys to know about is the SCORE Surgical Portal. This portal is great. This has access to multiple different textbooks on literally any different surgery topic. And not only that, it has questions at the end of these, and there's modules to help get you through and really determine if you're learning the content. It also has videos. A lot of them are actually the SAGES videos that I recommended earlier, but it has links to those, and it's just an all-around great site. For the Absite We're going to have a whole episode, multiple episodes on preparing for the ab site, and we're actually going to have reviews for the ab site to hopefully help everyone out there. But like we said before, the Pfizer ab site book, great book. Question Bank, the most popular one out there is the TrueLearn, formerly Surgery Weapon, and that was from Sarah B., and we like that here over on the West Coast also, so thanks for that. One resource I access a lot is actually go on PubMed and click the review and type in whatever subject I'm looking for, and it'll give me the newest, most up-to-date review articles covering those topics, and a lot of times it'll be more up-to-date than some of your other resources. And there are many other great resources out there. Really just pick a textbook, stick with it, and then start getting your ab site plan ready, and then have a separate plan for preparing for your operative cases, and you'll be ahead of the rest. And with that, let's hear from our last resident interview.
So we're pleased to have Sarwat Ahmad, who's a second-year researcher about to start a third year at the University of Maryland. And you can find her blog, Loose Sutures, on Tumblr. And wrote just a fantastic article talking about intern year and kind of had 10 points of dealing with. We're just going to run through them. Number one, always follow up. Number two, every action has a reaction. Number three, trial and error. Number four, do not deteriorate as a person. Number five, go over the plan with a nurse. Number six, sign out on time. Seven, write everything down. Eight, don't be lazy. Nine, do not feel entitled. And 10, personal relationships are not the priority. Sarwat, thanks for joining us so much on Behind the Knife.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
So, Sarwat, I was hoping you could take us through maybe one or two of these points and give us an anecdote that would be useful for our interns here as they're about to start coming up in July 1st.
Okay, so one of the big stories that sticks with me from intern year, I kind of have a post on my blog that goes into a little bit more detail, but I'll just say it briefly. And then from that story come like three of those lessons that I wrote in the 10 list.
Perfect.
So basically what happened, and this happens pretty commonly during intern year, you'll get a direct admission in the middle of the night. You won't even know that the patient's coming, and the nurse will just let you know, hi doctor, your patient is here. And you might be really busy admitting patients from the ER, having consults, and not have the, you know, the time or the ability to see that patient right away. So this is something that happened during my intern year. The overnight resident got a direct admission and was so overwhelmed with other things, wasn't able to, you know, properly assess the patient right away. And then in the morning, we weren't able to see that patient right away because she was located on a really far distant side of the hospital that wasn't part of our normal rounds. And so I feel like we delayed seeing the patient. A lot of the things that come with an admission, like labs and vitals, all that stuff got delayed, and we didn't see it until a lot later. And the patient ended up being very sick and had a little bit of a delay in care. And so from that, what I learned was, and a lot of these things were preventable, and what I learned was, one, always go see the patient, even if you have, if you can steal just 5 minutes to go see the patient and make sure they're stable. That's very important. Don't just assume that they're stable because they're not complaining about anything. This patient was very stoic and had no, wasn't asking for anything. So the overnight resident just assumed that they were okay. So always see the patient. And then two is don't be lazy. And that means that just because the patient's all the way on the other side and you're, you know, you may be busy doing other things, that doesn't mean that you can put that off until later. Prioritize laying eyes on someone and doing your exam. And then the other thing was to follow up. For this particular patient, a lot of the orders had been placed overnight from a distance from the patient, and there was like no communication with the nurse on whether these orders were actually completed. So we didn't see labs until like 12 hours after the patient was admitted because there was no follow-up. And so I always tell my interns, if you order something, make sure it's done, make sure the labs are drawn, make sure you've seen them before you sign out, because putting in an order is just the very tip of the iceberg on what it takes to get something done for your patient. And so just one thing I learned from overnight admissions is that they can be pretty disastrous, and you really want to make sure that they're all, you know, they're, you got all your bases covered before you sign out the patient to the next person coming on.
And don't be lazy. You know, we all think we're motivated, driven people, but when you're at 3 in the morning and dealing with chest tubes and, you know, broken IVs in other rooms and you get these calls, it's a whole nother story. Or you're trying to get your 30 minutes of sleep so you can survive through the next day of rounds. It's a whole nother world.
I think it's interesting. I commend you on having a surgical journal during your intern year, because I think that there's nothing that speaks towards learning as your own voice. And you said it best. You looked back and found it right on your blog that you looked back and you found an interesting one that you could share with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty important.
And now, speaking of getting slammed with work, and could you just tell us how your first 2 years of residency, what did you do to keep your spirits high and to not get beat down by a general surgery residency?
So I think that I did burn out towards the end of my first year, and then I had to sort of revive myself in second year. And the way that I did that was to stay positive. It's so easy to get bogged down by all the negativity around you. You know, there's just like everyone's tired and, you know, people are very sick, and you can start complaining like everyone else. But I think that once I started kind of ignoring all of that and staying positive and like remembering that I tried to convince myself I was having a lot of fun, and then I just started having a lot of fun. And I think that comes with getting through intern year and then starting to feel very capable. And I think that once you start feeling like you can do this and that you're valuable to the team, it starts being really fun. And so I think that when I started feeling that way, my morale really, really responded to that.
And you know what? I bet your med students and other residents probably noticed that, because I can tell my own reaction when other residents are having fun and enjoying the time versus the ones that act miserable. It really makes a difference on me. And two of my, Wayne Causey and Thomas Chali, when I was a med student, both of these guys were just fired up, excited, motivated people that really made me excited about general surgery. So it makes a big difference on people you work for and people under you.
So, I agree.
Well, we just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing some stories. Do you have any other quick words of wisdom that you can tell the interns out there?
So kind of going along with what you just said, what somebody once told me was try to think of the surgical resident that really inspired you to go into surgery when you were a med student. Like, think of how good they were, how much you liked to spend time with them, how much they taught you, and just strive to be that person when you're an intern, when you're a resident. Like, you might get so busy with work, but if you just keep in mind, like, who were the people that helped me get through or helped me gain an interest in surgery, and you try to be like that, then that really helps how positive you can be and how excited you are, because, you know, that's what gets people interested. So I think that you keep role models in mind and don't forget them even when things get hard.
I think that's perfect, and we really appreciate you taking the time to join us on Behind the Knife.
Yeah, and you can find her blog at Tumblr, and just look up Loose Sutures and Sarwat Ahmad, and you can find the specific one regarding intern year by intern-year. Thank you so much for joining us.
So as we kind of close out this thing, there's a couple more things that we want to touch base on, and I think probably the most important thing from you guys who have just been it is, what are some thoughts about just in general about intern year? What are, you know, closing parting thoughts about intern year? What can you tell us?
Realize that you fulfill an important role. You know, your role as an intern, really, especially early on being an intern, your role is to gather information. I don't really care if my intern comes to me and he doesn't know the right answer or what exactly to do, but I care if he has the right information. Know where to get that information. Know everything you can about the patients on the service. If, you know, everything about their past medical history, everything about their home meds, everything about the surgery that they've had. And when something happens, when an event happens, you know, get there early so that you're able to gather all the information you need to gather and be ready for the day.
Yeah, I think it's important that you just realize that, you know, rely on your fellow interns. You guys are a team across the board. You know, don't be a blue falcon, as people say. You know, just work together. You'll find that you get a lot more with, you know, I always say collaborate and dominate. You know, take whatever scenario is in front of you, because it doesn't matter what you're going into. A surgery rotation could be a ton of fun. Intern year is short-lived. There's nothing like looking back on your intern year and laughing. I can remember almost every one of my rotations when I was an intern and realizing some of the knucklehead things that I did that either somebody bailed me out on or the good Lord was looking down above, or monkeys, whatever you believe in. But the bottom line is the fact that it can be a wonderful experience, and it just continues right on into your next few years. But get through it. Everybody's a part of it. And understand one thing. In many cases, you are the primary person that is getting called. So you have to be prepared for that. Think through the scenario. There are going to be multiple different scenarios that occur time and time again that are very close, but individual results may vary. And to load the boat early, seek out help. But at the end of the day, it's you and the patient, and recognize that that's somebody's mom, somebody's dad, brother, sister, uncle, whatever it is, and just get out of bed, go see them, evaluate the patient, and go from there. Yeah. So
I think that's another very important point. As long as you keep the patient the most important thing, if don't let your ego get in the way. You know, if you don't try and cover anything up, don't let your ego get in the way. If there's something you don't know how to do, or you're concerned about the patient, as long as you keep that at the forefront of your mind, that the patient comes first, nobody's going to fault you.
Surgery is a wonderful field. It is a it gives time and time again. It gives just multiple opportunities. It gives wonderful patient interactions, and you get to, let's face it, you get to operate. You get to do everything medicine doctors do, and you get to operate.
That wraps it up for us. Thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife. Be sure to subscribe and give us some reviews and ratings on iTunes. We have a lot of great content that we're going to be publishing in the upcoming weeks, in the upcoming year. We have Dr. Matthews taking us through surgical management of pancreatitis. We have Dr. Hunt taking us through breast cancer. You name it, we have it. And if we don't, let us know and we'll get on it and we'll make an episode about it. We're also going to have Absite reviews. We're going to have more debates, and we're going to have some journal clubs. So subscribe and give us feedback, and spread the word to other residents out there, interns and med students that would benefit from this. And thanks for listening.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.